Good evening, everyone. Welcome to our 35th annual Fall Wisconsin Conference. Before we start, my name is Alex. I'm an alcoholic. Very happy to be here. We're very fortunate tonight to have Father Mack with us to give us the invocation. And I recall that in 1973, on October 20th, and it took that long for me to get back and take on this wonderful responsibility, this privilege that we have here, Father Mack was the same individual that gave invocation on that night, and it, believe me, it's just great to present him to you. You all know him. Let's give him a great big hand. Big round of applause for Father Mack.
Before I give you the invocation, I got a new joke I have to tell you. We'll wait till afterwards. Somebody said, what do these four people have in common? Billy Graham, Jim Hillis, that's the coach at University of Wisconsin, Bamberger, and Forrest Gregg. What do they have in common? And the answer is, they have this in common, that there are four people, the only four, who can get 50,000 people to stand up and shout, Jesus Christ. Is that okay, Alex? Okay. All right, now we'll talk to God. Heavenly Father, we are your little children. We are dependent upon you in every way. Yet in our dependence is our strength. For you have made us independent of drugs and booze. Moreover, you have revealed to us the secret of how to arrest the symptoms of alcoholism. And following Bill Wilson's 12 steps, we can now achieve sobriety of body, mind, and soul. Your Son, Jesus Christ, remarked this when he said in Luke chapter 10, I praise you, Father, for hiding all these things from the wise and the prudent, and revealing it to the little children. We praise you, and AA praises you too. Amen.
Now we can eat. I heard Cecil. I'll be back. Was in 1968, St. Joseph's High School in Kenosha, Wisconsin. One of my early conferences that I attended, and believe me, it was outstanding. At that time, they had two speakers for the evening, one before the banquet and one after. And as if I recall correctly, the early speaker's name was Tom, and the guy was just so terrific. I says, oh, boy. I said, it's going to be another one. I said, I'm keeping my fingers crossed for him. And I'll tell you something. It was even better. I know that we all know him. We've seen him here in Milwaukee many times. He has given us a wonderful message, and I know that it's going to be an outstanding message tonight. I know he doesn't need an introduction. Just help me in welcoming our friend Cecil C. And now listen to this one, because I rehearsed it all week. From Prince Albert, Saskatchewan, Canada. How about it? A big hand.
That's the first in the United States. I want you to know that I'm usually somebody, but nobody takes a chance on saying Saskatchewan. But I'm proud of you, Alex. My name is Cease Corgill, and I'm an alcoholic. And I'm very grateful to be here. I'm grateful to be anywhere, as a matter of fact. And I'm also grateful to be invited back, because there was a time in my life that I never was invited the first time. And it's difficult to be invited back if you haven't been invited the first time. And I certainly was never invited to speak, but I used to go anyway, and I always managed to say a few words. I want to congratulate Wisconsin for your chairman introducing all of the trusted servants, the present ones and the past ones, and I often wondered, I'm a past trustee and past delegate, past everything, and I found out the highest you can get was sober, so I quit. And but to see, I often wondered why Wisconsin was always had such good people come up there to the General Service Conference, and now I know why, is you keep them active, and they show up at these deals, and they don't get lost when they're finished their job as a trusted servant. And I just want to congratulate you, because that is not the way it is everywhere. And so I was real proud of you tonight when I saw all of the trusted servants, past and present, stand up. And I was talking to your trusted servant, your trustee, Jack, and I was telling him that the only thing that can destroy our fellowship is ignorance and apathy. Ignorance of what we belong to, and straight genuine apathy. You know, not, you know, where we get complacence, but where apathy really sets in. And I gave quite a talk on it to your trustee, and I asked him, I said, what do you think of that? And he said he didn't know and he didn't care. So I don't know whether you've chosen the right one there. But last night when I got in here, you got in yesterday afternoon, and John and his friend over there met me at the airplane, and they didn't bring a car. I don't know why. They cheapskates. They kept phoning for the guy to pick them up from the hotel, and the guy kept coming, but coming to the wrong place. And we finally got here about 2 hours late, and then I found out it had been faster to walk, you know. But so that's one reason I'm really grateful to be here. But and then I went to my room because I was tired. I'd been up from early in the morning and flying a whole long ways. Then last night, and I went and listened to Carl and sat at the head table and really enjoyed Carl, because he knows, he talks about a big book, which is very important to me. And then I went to bed, and I was having a difficult time sleeping. And finally I fell asleep, and I just wasn't really sleeping so sound, but I started having some strange dreams. And I had a real strange dream, because I dreamt that I died and went to heaven. And that's really not that strange. I guess I hope I go there someday, but it was, at last night it seemed a little strange. And I saw Mike from Chicago up there. And St. Peter was showing me around, and I see Mike, and Golly, on his arm was the most horrible-looking thing I'd ever seen. A little pygmy-type thing with face on her like a torn boot. And you know, just awful. And I said, what's the idea? I said, I know that guy. I said, he was a great delegate. I was trustee when he was delegate. I've known him. I've been places with him. And he's just a fine fella. And St. Peter says, well, you know, old Mike almost didn't make it. And that's the penance he's going to have to pay. Until such time as, for probably 5,000 years. And so I walked along, and then I saw your speaker last night, Carl. And boy, if you think what was on Mike's arm was bad, you should have seen what was on Carl's arm. She had a face on her like a torn boot and a festered fig and everything else, you know, and just terrible. And I said, look, that guy, he's a real good member of Alcoholics Anonymous. Even if he's a hillbilly, he still knows the big book, you know? And I said, he's a great guy. And he said, yeah, but old Carl almost didn't make it, and that's a penance he's going to have to pay for 5,000 years. And then I said, old Moose. And there's Moose walking along, and on his arm is Joan Collins. And can't you see Moose just strutting out there, you know? And I said, well, why should those other two guys have these horrible things on their arms? And look at old Moose, he's got Joan Collins. And he says, well, Joan Collins almost didn't make it either. A very good friend of mine by the name of Jack Sennon from Dana, Saskatchewan, Canada. He's speaking there tonight. Now, you probably don't know who Jack Sennon is, and you probably don't know where Dana, Saskatchewan, Canada is, but that really doesn't matter. But he promised me he'd mention my name up there if I'd mention his name down here. And I've been really, really, I've been watching the committee. I always watch the committee when I go to these deals, and I'm privileged to go to a lot of them. And I've been watching your committee, and boy, they get along pretty good, you know. I'm sure they had a few fights behind the stage somewhere, but none of them were in the open, and I could see that. They're getting along pretty good and smiling, and that doesn't always happen at conferences, I tell you, you know, because the committees, you know, our self-centeredness comes out, and, you know, we think we should be running the show, and that lousy chairman doesn't know this and doesn't know that, you know, and it gets a little bit of friction. But this one, I think everybody has been getting along really well. That was my observation. And that's very important, that we get along with each other, because it teaches us that in the traditions. That's the object of this exercise in the traditions, is get along with our fellow man. And it reminds me of a story. It doesn't really. I intended to tell it all along, but story of a golfer that had a really, really bad day out golfing. And he was in the clubhouse, and he's sitting there by himself, and he just had a bad day, and he said, oh, God. And a voice came down and said, yeah, what's the trouble? He looked up, and he says, that you, God? And God said, yeah, that's me. And he said, what seems to be the trouble? And he said, well, I just can't putt. And he said, well, tomorrow when you're out there, just move your right hand around a little bit, and I'm sure everything will be all right. So while he had him on the line, he thought, by golly, I better have a little more of a chat with him. So he says, tell me, God, do they have a golf course up in heaven? And God said, just a second, I'll check. And he went away, and he came back, and he says, I got some good news, I got some bad news. He said, first, for the good news, they have the most beautiful golf course I've ever seen. And so the golfer says, well, what can be the bad news? And he said, your tee-off time is 10 after 8 tomorrow morning. So it's kind of important, you see, that we be on good terms with each other, because we never know when our tee-off time is going to be. And speaking of golfers, I was thinking tonight when the chairman here, I was in Amarillo, Texas a few years ago, and they had a big banquet, some like everything, of course, big in Texas. But But that night they had a real big banquet, and the chairman was a young member of Alcoholics Anonymous, and he'd never chaired a big banquet before, and he was really, you know, he was nervous about it. And that morning, on the Saturday morning, about 6 o'clock in the morning, he's there, and he's making notes and getting all ready, you know, and just like Alex does here, you got everything written down, and his wife is watching him, and they're staying at the hotel, and she said, tell me, honey, if something was to happen to me, would you get married again? You know, this is 6 o'clock in the morning, fellas, you know, and how do you answer that, you know? And so he said, well, I guess, you know, I'm a pretty young man, probably wouldn't. He continues doing what he's doing, you know, and she said, well, would you move her into our house? He said, well, she'd have to stay somewhere. She might as well move in there. The mortgage is all paid for. What's the difference, you know? And so he keeps on doing what he's doing, and she said, what about the bedroom? And he said, well, she's got to sleep somewhere. He said, so what? You know, it's been a good bed, and you know that, and it's a fine place. What's wrong with that? So she said, what about my jewelry? And he said, well, if you don't will it to somebody else, I guess it's okay with me if she wears it. And he keeps doing what he's doing. And she said, what about my car? He said, well, it's a small car, and what the heck, the gas crunch is on, she might as well have it, it's all paid for. She said, what about my golf clubs? He said, oh, no, not your golf clubs. She said, you would marry her, move her into my house, let her sleep in my bed, let her wear my jewelry, let her buy my car, what's wrong with my golf clubs? And he said, she's left-handed. So I thought I'd mention that, girls, because, you know, more and more the gals are working with us in conventions. They're doing a big job. There's a lot of delegates now and trustees, ladies. And but you ever notice, fellas, they're always projecting things of what might happen. And I'd just stop that if I were you girls, because you never can tell what we husbands will say. As I said, my name is Cease. I'm an alcoholic, and I'm not going to tell you too much about my drinking tonight because I don't think it's really important. I'll just tell you this. I did drink. I'm not here by mistake. I didn't set out to be here. I didn't set out to be an alcoholic. I didn't set out to be a member of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I just didn't waken up one morning and jump up and say to Babe, my good wife, by golly, I think one of what I should do today, gee whiz, I think I'll join Alcoholics Anonymous. It didn't happen that way at all. I was real proud of Carl last night when he talked about the big book, and I can't quote the big book like he can quote it, but last night he quoted this, men and women drink essentially because they like the effect produced by alcohol. But he finished, and he said, to them, their alcoholic life seems the only normal way. But the next line that he didn't talk about was, they are restless, irritable, and discontented. A lot of people don't talk about that too much, but let's just think for a moment. We as alcoholics, we as members of Al-Anon, we as members of Alateen, just think about being restless, irritable, and discontented. Before I ever drank, I can remember I set out to be an athlete. I didn't want to drink, I didn't smoke, I wanted to be an athlete, and I became a pretty good athlete. But when I was 16 years of age, I became restless, irritable, and discontented. I didn't like the discipline of my home, the discipline of my church, the discipline of my school, and so I ran away from it. And I ran into the service, 16 years of age, just like you, Carl. And I guess I was running away from discipline. And I show you, I wasn't too swift. I ran into the army. And I found out what discipline was all about. And I was in that army, and I started to love that army. But all of a sudden, I got restless, irritable, and discontented in that army. By this time, I'm drinking, because the first day I was in the army, I started to drink, and I guess it's the first time I ever drank in my life, as far as I know, 16 years of age. I became an instructor. But I was all of the time restless, irritable, and discontented. We were here, and I wanted to be over there. I wanted to be back in civilian life. And one day the army let me go back in civilian life. And I was still only 17, and I went back. I got a home, and I got a good job in an aircraft factory, and I got a lot of responsibility. And all of a sudden, I became restless, irritable, and discontented once again. And I know some of you will identify with this. If we're here, we want to be over there. And we get over there, we want to be back here. And we're restless and we're irritable and discontented. And that happened to me. And I was in that, had that good job in that aircraft factory, and all of a sudden I just didn't like the responsibility. I didn't know it then, but after coming to Alcoholics Anonymous, I figured it out. And I ran once again, I ran back into the service. And this time I had told them I'd never been in before, and I was a real genius. And I got recommended for my commission in the Canadian Army, and I would like to stand here and tell you that I was an officer in the Canadian Army. But because of I was restless, irritable, and discontented, then I got kicked out of the Army the second time. And I went back home. I got a job in a newspaper. By this time, I'm drinking pretty good. And in that newspaper, I got responsibility. I was in the advertising department. And it was a good job because I could leave the plant and I could go out selling advertising and get out and then get lost. And it didn't really matter as long as I brought some advertising in for the next day. But there I got too much responsibility, and I became once again restless, irritable, and discontented. And I left that job. And I went into the Navy. And I told them I'd never been in before, and boy, this time I was really something else. I got recommended for my commission. I went away to officer's training. And I'd love to stand here and tell you I was an officer in the Canadian Navy. But I got kicked out of officer's training. It seems that another officer didn't appreciate me telling him what to do with his ship. And I was in Florida not too long ago, and I looked at some of those big ships, and really it's a physical impossibility to do with that ship. What I told him. But I was in that Navy, and I got restless, irritable, and discontented. I stayed in the Navy till the war packed up. And I became a gunner on a merchant ship after I left officer's training. I sailed all over the world, and I drank all over the world. Didn't think there was anything wrong with it. Everybody was doing it. I would like to tell you people that I sailed with many of your people. I was down in the South Pacific, New Zealand, Australia, worked with a lot of your people. As a matter of fact, our Canadian ship, the ship I was on, we did a lot of work for you people down there, and I'd like to tell you about it because nobody's really given me anything for that. Never mention it. But I was in Melbourne, Australia, and one of your ships got torpedoed, and they towed it back in and salvaged it. It was loaded with tanks, and our ship was the only ship that was empty, and they ordered us to take your tanks up to New Guinea. And we went up there with your tanks. I don't mean you're drinking people. Are you with the real tanks, you know? That we went up there and we had a cargo of liquor that we took down to New Zealand, Australia, and all we had to do was steal some to get some, and so we all became pretty good liquor thieves, and we were going up there, and we were drinking pretty good, and the Japanese were very narrow about people bringing stuff like that in, and they were shooting at us, and we got your tanks delivered, and I want you to remember that. We delivered your tanks to New Guinea. And we're coming back out, and our own aircraft came out to meet us from Melbourne, Australia. And we thought it was the Japanese aircraft coming back. And because we weren't seen too well, and we started to shoot at our own aircraft. And suddenly the gunnery officer realized we're shooting at our own aircraft, and he got kind of panicky. I don't know why we weren't hitting them, and you have to visualize. He's standing up here, like on the bridge, and I'm down there, and I'm in charge of this big forward gun, and he's got a big megaphone, and he's got to stop us from shooting, and he hollers down, and he said, "Cease fire!" So I fired, you know. I thought he'd been friendly. He hadn't called me Cease before, but so I kept the war going for a few more days and became an alcoholic, and now you're stuck with me. But we, after the war, and I got married while I was in the Navy, and I'm still married to the same little girl, but I'd like to stand here and tell you I was a good husband and a good father, but I wasn't. I was an alcoholic husband, alcoholic father, And in my marriage, I became restless, irritable, and discontented when I got back home. And I was always wanting to be over here, and I was always wanting to be over there. And thank God I'm still where I am, where I'm supposed to be. And that's 40-some years ago that I got married to that little gal. And that's some sort of record today. And I got back home, and I started celebrating the end of the war, and I guess I celebrated the beginning of the Korean War, and I start getting jobs, and I start losing jobs because I was always restless, irritable, and discontented. I would tell people what to do with their jobs, and some guys were narrow about that, and they tried to do it, and I wasn't working there any longer. And, you know, it was just a way of life with me. And the last 2 years that I drank, I became a fighter. I was watching DeWitt fight today, didn't do well. And I didn't do so well either. I had 17 knockouts and 17, I had 17 fights, 17 knockouts, and I lost them all. And I wasn't fighting in any ring. I was just fighting wherever I could find somebody because I was very arrogant, because I was restless, irritable, and discontented, and I was disappointed with myself, and I became very arrogant, and that's how I had fights. I became a gambler. I didn't become a gambler. I started gambling more, and had an obsession to gamble. And I mention that was because that's how I got to Alcoholics Anonymous, fighting and gambling. I was at a stag party one night. I was 27 years of age. And I was at this stag party, and we were in a poker game. And I did an unforgivable thing. I got caught cheating. And it's okay to cheat in a poker game, but God, don't get caught. And I got caught by a man that weighed 275 pounds, and he was an ex-commando in the Canadian Army. And he and I had a fight. Or I should say, he had a fight. He hit me, and I hit the cement floor, and I got up, and he hit me, and I hit the cement floor. We did that a whole bunch of times. And finally, I stayed down, not because I didn't want to get up, because I couldn't get up. And I went to hospital. And, you know, I like to think today that there wasn't anybody knew I was in hospital from my town, because nobody came to visit me, not even my own family. And my doctor came in my fifth day in hospital, and he'd been in the service with me, thank God for that. And he said, Cease, you know, I knew you in the service, and you could have got along real well in the service, but you drank too much, and things haven't improved since you got home. And he said, I think you're an alcoholic. And he said, the rest's up to you. And I said, well, what should I do? And he said, well, I would suggest that you join Alcoholics Anonymous. And thank God he told me the truth about myself. He didn't leave it at that. He went and told a couple of people that in Alcoholics Anonymous, and they came to see me. And I can remember the two guys that came to see me. That's a long time ago, but I can remember it so well. Bill was the sloppiest drunk, I'm sure, in all of Canada. But this night he was dressed up in a nice brown suit, and he had a nice silk shirt and a bow tie, and he was clean, and his hair was combed, and his shoes were shined. And he looked so good, and Bill didn't even have to talk because I knew that something had happened to him. The other fellow was Earl, a fellow I'd been in the service with, and when Earl came back from the service, he got in a little trouble in Canada, and he got sentenced to 5 years in prison for robbery with violence. And he found Alcoholics Anonymous in prison. And both of them, I could see the look on their face, and I knew they were dressed so well. I don't mean they had $700 suits on or anything, but they were clean, and they looked good. And I think it's so important that when we get the opportunity to go and see somebody, that we look that way. I don't mean that we dress up to the hilt. I just mean that we look clean, and we look good, and it says this thing's based on attraction rather than promotion. I wanted that night what I saw in those two men. Both of those men are now dead. Bill died sober. Earl went back drinking and drowned. He fell into the river and drowned. But that doesn't matter. The thing is that they brought the message to me that night. And I know now why I became an alcoholic. I didn't know it then. I became an alcoholic because I'm a Protestant. Don't laugh, you Catholics. I grew up in a Catholic community. That's really why I became an alcoholic. I was probably the only Protestant that lived there. And I grew up hating Catholics. Because they did bad things to me, like they called the bingos in Latin so that I couldn't understand them, you know. And they were just mean to me. And here I am in a Catholic hospital. And that's before Medicare back in Canada. And I'd given a bad check because I'd come out of a poker game that I hadn't done too well in. This little nun couldn't find a place to cash my check, and she wouldn't let me out of hospital until I paid for that check. Because I was Protestant, mind you. That's the reason way I was thinking at the time. I phoned the only person in the world that I knew my credit was any good with, and that was my bootlegger. And he came and got me. He was a taxi driver, and he paid my check, and he took me down to meet these people that had been to see me in the hospital, these two members of Alcoholics Anonymous, and they said they were going to have a group of people in this restaurant, and they wanted to see me. And I went directly there with the taxi driver. And I wish you could have seen me that morning. I have always liked nice clothes. I still like nice clothes. I hope you think I have on nice clothes anyway. I kind of like the jacket myself. I've heard some bad remarks about it, but I like it. Today I pay for my clothes. That time I didn't. But that morning my shirt was all torn. It was covered with blood. My suit was torn. It was covered with blood. And I went down to this place to meet these people from Alcoholics Anonymous. And they all came. Every one of them that was in the group. I knew every one of them. I come from a small town, 35,000. At that time, it was probably about 25,000. And I knew every one of them. And I hadn't seen them for a while. I guess they weren't going to the same place as I was. Golly, I liked them. I just liked what they said and got along good with them. And we had a few laughs. And it was really something. And then they decided that they wanted to take me home. And I said, no, I can go home by myself. Because I'd finally found some real nice friends. My wife was always a little narrow if I was away for 3 or 4 days. And this time I'd been gone for 5 days. Mind you, it was in the hospital. But I figured that, you know, if they took me home, she would carry on the way she usually did. And I'd lose the friends that I'd finally found. But they insisted on taking me home, and thank God some of the wives had been up to see my wife. And I say some of the wives because that was before Al-Anon in our area. They had explained to her what the boys were going to try to do with me. And we went to our first meeting that night, but when we walked into my house that day, Babe kissed me. And she said, I think everything's going to be okay, hon. Boy, I'm telling you, that kept me in Alcoholics Anonymous that day. I thought, if this thing can change her that much, this is for me. And we went to a meeting on a Saturday night. And I'll tell you that it was a strange thing. I mean, there were a bunch of old people there. Some of them were 40, 50 years old. And here I'm 27, and I'm thinking, what have I got myself into? And I can remember they had a social first, and they played games. And I can remember them playing Pin the Tail on the Donkey. Ooh. That just wasn't my idea of a Saturday night, I'll tell you. And then they had a meeting. And I can remember a guy standing up and saying that he was sober for 1 year. And I knew him, and I sat in the back, and I thought, liar, you know. I knew him, and I knew that he was a traveling salesman. I knew that he must go out on the road and drink and then come in and tell these donkeys that he's sober. And that's the way I was thinking. And after the meeting, a couple of the old-timers, who were sober about 18 months, took me in another room, and they said, Cease, You heard someone say tonight that there's no musts in Alcoholics Anonymous. I've since found out that there are a lot of musts, but that's what they said at that time. But they said, tomorrow morning, there's a meeting here at 8 o'clock, and you must be here. And I'm grateful that they talked to me like that, because I have never stopped going. That was January the 16th, 1952. And because of you people, because of a loving God, as I understand him, and because of the fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous, I have never had to have another drink. And I can say that I've been a grateful and active member of Alcoholics Anonymous since that time. And for this, I'm very grateful. And it was just beautiful. And I didn't want to come to Alcoholics Anonymous. Don't think that I really wanted to. I was full of joy or anything for coming here. But I didn't really have that too many places to go, and at least they were talking to me. And so I came. I was something like, and I'm telling this joke because I was asked to tell it. I was something like the three alcoholic rabbits. I don't know whether you've ever seen an alcoholic rabbit down here. I don't mean an ordinary Saturday night drunk rabbit. I mean a real, genuine alcoholic rabbit. We have them up in Canada. They sit by the fences, and their ears are drooping down. And there were three of them. There was Foot and Foot Foot and Foot Foot Foot. And Foot Foot used to phone him Foot Foot Foot, and he'd say, let's pick up old Foot. We'll go down to the bar. So Foot 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 and Foot Foot, to pick up old Foot, they go down to the bar. And one night Foot Foot was sitting talking to Foot Foot Foot, and Foot 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 said to Foot Foot, he says, where's Foot? And Foot Foot said to Foot Foot Foot, he's here just a minute ago, but he went outside. So Foot 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 Foot, they went outside, found poor old Foot. Foot was dead. So Foot Foot said to Foot Foot Foot, he says, what do you think we should do with Foot? And Foot 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 said to Foot Foot, he said, well, I think we should take him to the funeral home. And after the funeral, Foot Foot said to Foot Foot Foot, he said, what do you think old Foot died from? And Foot 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 said to Foot Foot, he said, well, I think he was alcoholic. And Foot Foot said to Foot Foot Foot, he said, you think we're alcoholic? And Foot 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 said to Foot Foot, he said, well, we're drinking quite a bit. And Foot Foot said to Foot Foot Foot, he said, do you think we should join Alcoholics Anonymous? And Foot 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 said to Foot Foot, might as well. He said, we got one foot in the grave anyway. And that's what I was like. I thought you had to have one foot in the grave before you came here. But I had a great time in Alcoholics Anonymous. I stayed sober just by pats on the back. I was the youngest member in the whole province of Saskatchewan. And that's a big province, about three times the size of Texas, I want you to know. And I was the youngest member. And people in my group would pat me on the back and say, boy, you're doing a fine job. And I just loved that. We'd go to deals, not nearly as big as this, but we'd go to deals like this on some weekends, and I'd get patted on the back and say, you're still sober, eh, kid? And you're doing well, fine, hear good things about you, you know. And golly, it was really great. That's what I'd been looking for all of my life. And then a horrible thing happened right in our group. Some younger members came in. And they walked right by me and went to talk to those old members. And the older members went right by and talked to the newer members. And there I am, all of a sudden, and I share this with you because I don't care whether you're an Al-Anon, Alateen, or Alcoholics Anonymous, one day you're going to become a middle member. And it's a bad thing because it's just like being in a hole in a donut. You're nothing. You stand out there and people walk by both ways, you know, and you're just standing there all by yourself. And I thought about going out and, you know, having a few and coming back and getting that old treatment again. But thank God I didn't have to do that. Because we had a guy in our group at that time by the name of Ernie Sear. Ernie's now gone to that greater roundup. But we asked Ernie if he would chair our meetings for the next 3 months. And we have discussion meetings where I come from. And Ernie said, well, he would chair the meetings, providing we'd do one thing. And we said, what's that? And he says, well, I want the bunch of us, as a group. He says, what's been happening? We've been discussing step one, and then step eight, and then step five. And he said, "That I don't think that's what that deal means when we read how it works. He said, I want to start at step one in this book called Alcoholics Anonymous. And he said, I want to go through the steps, and I don't want to just talk about them. I want us to do them as a group. And I want to talk about them. We want to do them. And we thought we had humor all Ernie along, so that is the experience I want to share with you tonight. The experience I had since coming to this beautiful fellowship. And we went that first week, and Ernie gave us this big book, and we all had our big books. And he told us to read the first 57 pages. And he read some of them, and he said, now go home, and that's your first exercise. Just like homework. And we went home, we all did that. Come back next week and reported in that we'd done that. Boy, oh boy, you know, it even tells you in that first 57 pages that there is a solution. Same as your conference theme. And it tells you a whole bunch of things. And we came back, and then Ernie started on step one. And, you know, he read how it works every week. And he read the promises to us every week. And he told us we were entitled to those promises. And he used to say something that was really great. He said, don't gyp yourself. Get what's coming to you. And we took those steps, and we started with that step one where it says we admitted we're powerless over alcohol. And I didn't even know there was a second part to it, that our lives had become unmanageable. And we started to talk about that. He said, I'm sure we all admit we're alcoholics. We're powerless over alcohol. But what about the unmanageability of our lives? Well, we're all at Alcoholics Anonymous then, and we all thought we were well. And Ernie started pointing out to us where maybe we weren't. And he started reading, going over those first 57 pages when we found we were going through step one. And I found out that I had an unmanageable life as far as money is concerned. Now, it's stupid even talking about this down here because I know that none of you people have this problem. That you had financial problems. But supposing someday you sponsor somebody, you know, in Al-Anon or Alateen or Alcoholics Anonymous, and you find out that they've got an unmanageable life as far as money's concerned and that they're restless, irritable, and discontented. Well, tell them that you heard a speaker talk about that once and you know somebody else that had that. And I came to Alcoholics Anonymous owing $6,200. I know that's not a lot of money in Milwaukee. But I didn't owe it for anything. I just owed it, you know. I came here by way of a poker game. And if you put that into inflationary terms, that's about $30,000, I would imagine. And I had a real good job. I got an excellent job. I had a good job when I came here. I got a better job after I came here. And my boss took me, he got sick and tired of people phoning me and phoning him about this money that I owed. And he took me to the bank and he endorsed my note. And he and the bank manager sent the checks out. They didn't even allow me to do that. And they made my wife and I sign a paper that we would pay for everything that we bought. And 3 years later, that boss bailed me out for $7,500 because I had an unmanageable life as far as money was concerned. And then I found out something really strange. I found out that financial problems have nothing to do with money, but they has a lot to do with bigshotism, has a lot to do with pride, has a lot to do with ego. I was the kind of a guy that if I owed somebody $400, I wanted to walk in and I wanted to put his lousy $400 on the table and say, there it is, you know. Quit phoning me, you know. I had too much pride to go in and pay him $40 every month. And I got in serious trouble that way. You really get in serious trouble that way. And I know this sounds even ridiculous. You people know nothing what I'm talking about because you've never had this problem. But I'm telling you, I'm sharing my experience, strength, and hope with you. And so, to show you how this can really get you in trouble. You see, I didn't stop gambling because I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. I just thought I'd be a better gambler. And I got news for you. You can lose money sober. And those ponies, they don't run any differently, whether you're drunk or sober. And so, I just, you know, was trying to get along, and I was getting in trouble, and you start to tell lies. And about this time, I'd become an eye specialist. And by this time, my wife was in Al-Anon. Al-Anon had started. And I came home one day, and as I say, I was an eye specialist by this time. I did this, I did that, and sat down with our two little girls and with my good wife to have lunch, and she said, I thought you know, these sneaky Al-Anons fellas. She says, I thought you said you paid so-and-so. And I said, if I said I paid them, I paid them. And she says, well, why would they phone me today and tell me that you hadn't paid them? And, of course, you know what the great I did? I took my food, plate and all, threw it in the sink, broke it, ripped the phone off the wall, and said, they'll not be calling you anymore. And went in the front room and pouted. Now, this is sober. You see, some people think that unmanageability of your life is just when you're drunk. Anybody that drank that flit that I drank, I don't care, the finest old Baptist lady would get unmanageable if she drank that stuff I drank. But I'm talking about in sobriety, and a lot of people don't think that way. But to show you that I've changed just a little bit, a lot of years ago I owed a manufacturer $10,000. That's not a lot of money in my business because I'm in the fur coat business. But it's a lot of money in the middle of July when it's about 96 above. And this manufacturer was phoning me and saying some bad things to me, and finally I decided to write him a letter, and I told him I loved his merchandise and I would like to have fall dating on it, that I'd sold some on the layaway plan and I had small deposits, and then I threw a little, you know, philosophy at him. I said, if I had 10 miles to walk down a railroad track, it seemed like a long ways. But if I took it a telephone pole at a time, it would even seem further, but I'd finally get there. And I signed it, yours truly, Cecil E. Corgill, manager, Cecil Corgill Furs and Fashions. P.S. I'm enclosing a certified check for $100. Send it off. 4 or 5 days later, that's when the post office was operating properly, I got a letter back. And he congratulated me on my letter-writing ability, suggested I get out of the fur business, go writing letters for people. And he signed it, yours truly, Mo Amsel, Mamsel Amsel, Montreal, P.S. Would you mind sending me another telephone pole? You know? And I've sent him a lot of telephone poles. And today I don't owe him any telephone poles. But I learned something through that. And I learned when we were taking that step that you had to take charge of things. And so right away I said, look, I've never been to a mental hospital. How can I come back from somewhere I haven't been? I said, if I'm going to be restored to sanity, I must be insane. That's what you're telling me. They said, no, 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 Cease. They said, what is wrong is you are a negative thinker. And I was a negative thinker, I'll tell you. I was a negative thinker, especially when I was talking about you people. Something negative. Did you ever see a group of people sitting around trying to help somebody that's not there? And they say things like, you know, have you heard? Did you know? Isn't it awful? You know? I mean, I was that kind of a guy. I could sit for days talking about people like you or the weather or something. I was something like the negative barber. This guy slid into a barber chair one day and he said, like, a haircut last me 3 weeks. Barber said, why 3 weeks? He said, well, I'm going on vacation. Barber said, where are you going? He said, first of all, I'm going to London, England. Barber says, you're not going to London, England. He said, I am. He said, you're not. He said, I am. Wouldn't go there if I were you. He said, now, I've never been there, he said, but I heard. Lousy place to go, too many people, too many cars. Guy said, look, just cut my hair. If I don't like it there, I'm going on over to Paris. The barber says, you're not going to Paris. He said, I am. He said, you're not. I said, I am. Wouldn't go there if I were you now. He says, I've never been there. He said, but I heard that they really fleece the tourists there. The guy said, I don't care. If I don't like it there, I'm going to Rome. The barber says, you're not going to Rome. He said, I am. He said, you're not. I said, I am. Wouldn't go there if I were you now. He says, I don't know. But he says, I heard a lot of Catholics there. Yeah, but he said, The guy says there's a different kind of a Catholic there. He says, it doesn't matter, I'm a Catholic. Yeah, but he said, the barber says, I know, they're different. They're just different over there. So 3 weeks later, the guy comes back, slides into the barber chair. The barber said, how was your trip? He said, it was good. He said, it wasn't. He said, it was. He says, you didn't go to London. He says, I did. He says, didn't. He says, I did. He'd love to have stayed there longer, but wanted to get on to Paris. He says, you didn't go to Paris. He says, I did. He says, didn't. He says, I did. He says, I'd love to have stayed there long, but we want to get on to Rome. He says, you didn't go to Rome. He says, I did. He says, didn't. He says, I did. He says, as a matter of fact, I got an audience with the Pope. And he says, you didn't. He says, I did. He says, didn't. And he says, you'll never believe what the Pope said. He says, I knelt down to kiss the Pope's ring, and you'll never believe what he says. And the barber says, what? And he says, where the hell did you get that lousy haircut? Hey, I'm going to need more water. And I was something like the negative barber. I didn't know, but I'd heard, you know. But here they tell me that I have to, you know, that come to believe the power greater than myself could restore me to sanity. And they said, you got to pray. And I said, who to? And they said, doesn't matter, just pray. So I tried that, and it worked, and I stayed sober and got a little more comfortable. But I was still restless, irritable, and discontented. Do you ever get restless, irritable, and discontented in Alcoholics Anonymous or in Al-Anon or Al-Ateen? I tell you, I used to make up 12-step calls. You know? Because I wanted to get out of the house, because I was restless, irritable, just stand in the house. I know none of you members of AA would ever do that. But I'm talking about Canadian AAs. I did that. And I would say to my dear little wife, boy, I got to help that guy, you know. And where'd I go? Just go for a drive. And I'd get restless, irritable, discontented driving around. You see, you're still restless, irritable, discontented. So then they tell me that I have to make a decision. I had an unmanageable life. I found a manager in step two. And then they told me that I had to make a decision to turn my will and my life over to the care of God as I understood it. A lot of people say they understand them. It's God as I understood it. And so, you know, it's a difficult thing, isn't it, to make decisions? The reason we don't make decisions is we're afraid of making the wrong decisions. Somebody was talking, maybe it was Carl last night, about procrastination. The reason we procrastinate is because of fear. We're afraid of making a decision. An indecision will kill us in this program. We don't want to make that decision. We just don't want to make a decision. I have a friend of mine who was over in Ireland. And another friend was telling me about this, and he says, our friend was over there, and he said, all of a sudden, someone started to stuck a gun in his back. And he said, what are you? And he thought real fast, and he thought, if I say I'm Catholic and he's Protestant, he's going to shoot me. If I say I'm Protestant and he's Catholic, he's going to shoot me. And so he thought real fast, and he says, I'm Jewish. And the guy with the gun says, I'm the luckiest Arab in the whole wide world. You see? You know, sometimes we make the wrong decision, you know. And sometimes we can't make a decision at all. I don't know down here whether you know what a poacher is. A poacher back home is somebody that fishes out of season without a license or goes hunting, you know, without a license, out of season and everything. Well, we had this old poacher there, and he used to fish whenever he wanted to fish. They tried to catch him, and they couldn't catch him. And one day, a new game warden came to town, dressed up in old overalls, went down and made friends with his old poacher. 2 o'clock in the afternoon, the old poacher said, I want to go fishing. And he didn't know. He's talking to the game warden. So the game warden said, I'd like to go with you. So they go out there, and they get out in the middle of the stream, and the old poacher stops his boat, reaches over into a tin box, pulls out 2 sticks of dynamite, lights them, throws them in a drink, and you fisherman knows what happens. Boom, up comes the fish, out came the net, filled the old boat with fish, and out came the badge. And then the old game warden's giving it to him, telling him that he's finally got him. Then the old poacher, never bad an eye, reached over, got 2 more sticks of dynamite, lit them, handed them over to the old game warden. And the game warden's sitting there with 2 lit sticks of dynamite, and the old poacher says, look it, buddy, do you want to talk or do you want to fish? He made a decision, you know. So we just have to make those decisions, you know. I still have a difficult time with decisions. I've been sober 34 years. Tonight before I came up here, I was trying to decide whether I should go to the bathroom or not. And right now, I don't know whether I've made the right decision or not. But here we are at this step where we have to make a decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God as we understood him. And you know, if we read this big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I hope some do, it's quite a book. I think it's going to catch on after a while, too. But right, you know, how it works. If you look under there, it says, when it says that God could and would if he were sought, we read it every meeting, and it says, being convinced we're at step three, which is that we decide to turn our will and our life over to the care of God as we understood it. Just what do we mean by that, and just what do we do? You know, if you read the next couple of pages, you'll find out what our will is really like. And many of us go searching for God then, but you know, God's not lost. I mean, what we're supposed to do is find out what our will is. And when we find out what our will is, I guarantee that you'll want to turn it over. You won't want to be that way. And that's the object of the exercise in step three, is to turn that will over, get rid of our will. And I went down to the basement, I said, look at God, I've done a bad job of managing my life, you know, how about you taking over? And I had to keep it that simple. And I had to keep it simple because I find out if I complicate things, believe me, I'm in trouble. So I have to keep everything simple. I have a friend of mine back home that has a ranch. And another friend said, how'd you get the name of your ranch? And he says, well, I wanted to call it the Bar Q. My wife wanted to call it Susie Q. My son wanted to call it the Bar Susie Q. And my daughter wanted to call it Susie Bar Q. So we called it the Bar Q, Susie Q, Susie Bar Q, Bar Susie Q. And the guy said, that's a great name, but where are the cattle? And he said, none of them ever survived the branding, you know. And that'll happen to us. You know, we just won't survive the branding if we start to complicate it. Let's just keep it simple. Do what we're supposed to do, what this big book tells us to do. And then Ernie was a wise old man. He'd heard somebody say that we were doing this one step a week, you must remember, and studying this big book and doing what we were supposed to do. And boy, oh boy, we were probably the best class that ever went through those 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous because we were all so enthusiastic. And then Ernie had heard someone say that they couldn't find a pencil and a paper. That's the reason they didn't do their four steps. Old Ern, he came to the next meeting. He's got pencils and papers for every one of us. Passed them out, and he said, then he showed us step four and page 65. It's a very simple thing. It talks about, you know, I'm resentful at who and the cause and how it affects me. And we just studied that, and he said, okay, go on home now and do it. And we went home and did it. I came back, and I wanted to show it to Ernie. Ernie said, no, that's between you. And he said, personal. He said, checked with everybody else, and everybody else had done it. And we got our papers with her, and we're just really doing the job. And then he told us that week we studied step five, where we have to admit to God, to ourselves, and to another human being the exact nature of our wrongs. Now, a lot of people in Alcoholics Anonymous said, I went and took a step five with somebody. That's not what it says in the step. Or that's not what Ernie and we found out in this book. It says admit it to God, to ourselves, and then to another human being. And Ernie said you go home and you talk to God and you talk to yourself and then you go and talk to another human being. And that's what I had to do. I went in the bathroom so my wife wouldn't see me doing these stupid things. And then I knelt down, I talked to God, and then I got up and talked to myself in the mirror. And you know what? Between that space from here to Jack, I changed the story. When I go to the mirror, I'm telling a different story than I told God. I had to get down there again and get the story straightened out. And then talk to myself. And then I went and talked to another human being. You see, this is, when they say it's cunning, baffling, and powerful, I'll tell you, and when it says you're unmanageable, you know, you are unmanageable, and when it tells you you're restless, irritable, and discontented, I don't care whether you're sober or drunk. All those things apply. They did in my case. And so I went to this little minister, Protestant, mind you, and I went to have a chat with him. And I was having a tough time forgiving myself for some of the things I'd done. And I can remember that little guy sitting down talking to me. And I can remember how good I felt. And he knew what he was doing because he had studied Alcoholics Anonymous. And he'd taken a lot of part with people. And he took this book and he said, now you know what you're supposed to do now? And I said, yes. And he said, what are you supposed to do? And I said, well, I'm supposed to go find a quiet place and read step 6 and 7 out of my big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. And that night, I don't think there was ever a night where I was more willing, as step 6 says, to turn, you know, to have God remove all these defects of character and humbly ask him to remove our shortcomings, as it says in step 6 and 7. And I find as I go through the country and as new members come into our group in Alcoholics Anonymous back home, I find that when we're taking this step that most people were like I was. We were afraid of becoming too good too fast. Don't worry about that. I do this almost every Saturday night somewhere. And I just haven't run into a saint as yet in our fellowship. Not even in Al-Anon. I haven't found any saints. You see, when I got to these steps, as I said, I told you before, when I was back there in step 2 and 3, I was still gambling. And I was getting in a lot of trouble gambling. And I was getting in more financial difficulties. So because of step 6 and 7, I was able to get down on my knees, where it says, humbly asked him to remove our shortcomings. And I believe the only way that I can be humble is by getting down on my knees. If there's any definition of humility, I like the word one where it says, the ability to stand and the willingness to kneel. And I believe that that's what happened to me by learning what is in this big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I got down on my knees and I asked God to remove the obsession to gamble. And I don't have to gamble anymore. I can get in a little game of cards. It's boring. But I don't make up games and I don't drive to the next town to get in one. And I get no kick out of winning money. I get no kick out of losing it like I used to. So I got rid of that. And that was a bad thing with me, I'll tell you. Before that step 6, I used to swear a lot. I didn't change any in that department. I was the same way as I used to be when I was in the bar. And when I'd get with a group of fellas, I was cussing and swearing. And I'm in the fur coat business. And, you know, I don't think my customers would really appreciate me talking to them the way I talk to the guys in AA about a mink coat. And so I asked for help there. And the big reason I did that is because I can remember a businessman in our town who had a bad problem with booze. And his wife was going to Al-Anon. And one day I heard that he went to another meeting. Not at our group, thank God. Or maybe I wished he had come to our group. And she was in my store and I said, I hear some good news at your house. And she says, well, I don't know. And I said, well, I thought he went to a meeting. And she said, yeah. I said, well, didn't he enjoy it? And she said, well, I don't know. She came home and I asked him how the meeting was. And he said, well, it was kind of a funny meeting. He said they prayed a little bit. Then they swore a whole lot. They prayed again and we had a cup of coffee and came home. I hope and pray that that never happens in my meeting. That we scare somebody away with our profanity. And I'm not saying that you can swear as much as you want. Don't say that some donkey come down from Canada says you can't swear. I'm telling you what happened to me. And I don't think I have any right to swear from this podium. Because there may be somebody out there that brought their dear sister with them. Or brought their mother. To show them about this wonderful thing that they're in. This beautiful program. And can you imagine what dear old mother would say if I was up here cussing? See, it sounds like not a good place to go, daughter. You know? And I just hope that I never scare anybody away the way that businessman was scared away from that meeting. Because of my profanity. And we went on to step 8. And when it said, you know, made a list of all the people we'd harmed and become willing to make amends to them all. I said to Ernie, I did that in step 4. And Ernie said, if you were the kind of a drunk I am, you've hurt some people since step 4. Put them on the list. And he was true. He was right. I had. And I wrote them all down. I even put my own name down because I had lost my self-respect in my own hometown. And I wanted to forgive myself, and I was having a difficult time. And I wrote it down and became willing. And that's all Ernie asked us to do, was become willing. And then we went on to step 9, where we had to make those direct amends. And every week, Ernie had read those 12 promises to us and told us, don't forget, fellas, you're entitled. And when I say fellas, there weren't any girls, ladies in our group at that time in our city. And he used to say, look it, fellas, you're entitled to every one of those promises. And I found out by then that I was getting some of those promises by step 9. I also found something else out. And I want to share this with you because it was a big thing. I was no longer restless, irritable, and discontented. I was contented in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I wanted to be there. And I didn't care if I was an alcoholic. I didn't care if I was young. I didn't care. All I knew that I had a beautiful program. And it had 12 promises that I was entitled to. And Ernie said, don't gyp yourself, get them. And I was getting them. And I went and I did that step 9. And I made those direct amends to such people wherever possible, except when to do so would injure them or others. And up until that time, I had a difficult time marching down the main drag in our town. Because I would meet somebody coming and I'd have to go to this side of the street. Then I would meet somebody over here and I'd have to go to that side of the street because I had an amend to make them. Then I'd see them coming from both sides. I'd once again have to take to the back alleys where I used to be. And I don't want to live that way. Thank God because of this program and because of going through those steps in sequence. And because I'm no longer restless, irritable, and discontented, I can walk down the main drag of any city in the world and not be afraid to meet anybody because I've made the amends. I'm not saying I haven't hurt anybody since then, but I'll tell you what, the next 3 steps taught me they were growth steps. A lot of people call them maintenance steps. I love to call them growth steps because I think if we were to take this beautiful building and maintain it, it would stay the same. I don't want to stay the same. I want more out of this program. And so I call them growth steps, where it says, we continue to take personal inventory, and when we're wrong, promptly admit it. Each and every day when I go to bed, I have to take a look at Cease. And I have to figure out what Cease did wrong today. If I do something wrong and hurt you, I know how to say I'm sorry. I never, ever knew how to say that. If I react to somebody that said something to me, because I am still, my disease can still be aggravated by somebody. And so I can say, if I react, I can say halfway through the argument, look, I'm sorry. I'm sorry for losing my cool. And try that. Probably some morning, those people that live with us, you know, about 7:30, just as you're going to work, it seems that's when they want to have a stupid discussion about something. And sometimes we react. And halfway through the heated discussion by that time, just smile and say, I'm sorry. They don't know what to say. Kiss them smack on the lips and say goodbye, you know. And go and drive your car to work, you know, the right way. I don't think all of the accidents are caused by drunk drivers. I think a lot of them are caused at 8 o'clock in the morning by having a fight with that Al-Anon that's living in the same house as us, you know. Just think of that. We're driving everybody else's car, telling people to get out of the way, and then they come to a stop sign, you know, you crash the old horn. And I want to tell a story because there's some people say I told this story in Kenosha, and I probably did. It's a story about when I was sober about 10 years. And this might happen to you whether you're an Al-Anon, Alateen, or Alcoholics Anonymous. I forgot who I was and what I was and where I'd come from. I was going to AA, to my regular meetings all of the time. But I, all of a sudden, had the wrong attitude. I was working for the wealthiest man in our city, and I decided he should be the second wealthiest man. You know? And I went out to get some of that great material stuff, and I got some of it, but I forgot who I was. And I would go to a meeting with an attitude something like this, and I know this is sick, but I got to share it with you. You lucky people, here I am, you know? If some of you need some counseling, maybe I can spend a couple of minutes with you. That's the way I was thinking, really sick. I was doing a lot of institutional work. On my way out to the penitentiary, and I told this to our loved Virginia one time because her and I were buddies, I'll tell you. We were trustees together, and when Virginia left us the way she did, I'll tell you, I had a difficult day that day when I got the news. And I know that tonight she's up there at that big roundup, and she's got that big hat on, and she's saying old Cease is doing just as I'd want him to do it. And I'm glad that I can think of Virginia that way. But when I was doing these things, what I shared with Virginia about forgetting who I was and what I was, I was managing the largest ladies' wear in the province of Saskatchewan. I was looking after the fur department for 5 stores, and I had a big job. And I had a car, and I had an expense account, and, you know, and I thought I was great. And one day my boss called me in the store, and we were in his big store, and it seemed that the store wasn't quite big enough for the two of us. And it seemed he wasn't about to leave. And he fired the great Cease Corrigle. And I walked out of that store with an attitude something like this: well, they won't last long now. I want you to know they're still doing okay, they're still millionaires, and everything's all right. About that time, my little cousin Fern came to town. She was a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I was going to a little roundup, and about 400 miles away, and I bought some new threads, and I went down to talk to Fern. And I stood up in front of her in my big egotistical way, and I said, "Well, kid, how do I look?" And Fern said, and I'm going to share these with you, she said, "You look really good on the outside, Cease, but how are you really on the inside?" And I drove away to Flin Flon, Manitoba, with a dear old friend by the name of Dave Murray, who's now gone to that greater roundup too, and he didn't talk to me. He just let me drive, because he knew that maybe something was happening to me. And I went into Winnipeg, Manitoba, and I spent a couple of days in a hotel room talking to God about my future. I went back to my hometown, and I went into business for myself, and that's not important. I had to do something, but I did that. And I went back to Alcoholics Anonymous, and I'd never been away in attendance, but I'd been away. And I went back with the right attitude, the way I am, I hope. And I hope, growing a little bit each and every day. All because that little girl said that to me. Each and every day, I just don't take a chance on not doing that step. And when it comes to step 11, where it says, sought through prayer and meditation to improve our conscious contact with God as we understood him, praying only for the knowledge of his will for us and the power to carry that out. On page 86, 87, and 88 of this big book, and Mike and I were talking about that last night at dinner, it tells me exactly what to do each day. It says on page 86, on awakening, let us think about the 24 hours ahead. Now, I'm not the smartest person in the country, but on awakening, I like to waken up in the morning. So if some of you people say you do this at night, well, I don't know. I feel sorry for you. You sleep all day. But it says, on awakening, let us think about the 24 hours ahead. And I read that because it sets out my day for me. At the end of it, back on page 88, it says, we do not tire so easily, for we are not burning up energy foolishly as we did when we were trying to arrange it to suit ourselves. And I tell you, it is just wonderful. And I go in a little room by myself and I read the promises. And I read 86, 87, and 88. I read the prayer on page 63 and I read the prayer on page 76. And I read the last part of A Vision for You. Some people say that you must get up about 3 o'clock in the morning. It takes about 7 minutes to do that. If you rush it, you can do it faster. I read other things. I read Vincent Peale, Emmett Fox. Sometimes I read the Bible. I know it's not conference-approved literature, but I take a chance. Now, and I have some prayer and some meditation. And I get ready for my day. Because, you see, you never know who's out there to get you. There's people out there that don't realize we're sensitive. And they aggravate our illness by saying bad things to us. Maybe a bank manager. Maybe the people you're living with. Could be your boss. It could be your employees. Could be anybody. Irate customer. Manufacturer. Can be anybody. And you've got to be ready for them. And I'll tell you that there's another story about an old poacher. And the game warden's name was Ralph. And old Ralph was really trying to catch this old poacher, and he couldn't. But one night he went down and he bedded down outside this old poacher's house. And he thought, I'll catch him in the morning when he comes out, because sure, he will do something wrong. 4 o'clock in the morning, the door started to creak open, and old Ralph thinks, boy, I'm going to catch him now. The old poacher poked his head out, and he says, do you want some breakfast, Ralph? And Ralph come out of the hay and went in, and he's having breakfast. And he says to the old poacher, he says, how did you know I was out there? And the old poacher said, I didn't. But every morning for the past 5 years, he says, I've said, do you want some breakfast, Ralph? You see, you got to be ready for them. And you don't take those chances. You get ready for that day. And I want to share something beautiful that happened one morning when I was doing my reading. I talked about Catholics and everything like that, but, you know, things have changed a little bit. Our daughter, Faye, who was probably given everything when she was a girl, when she was a young girl, and you'll never believe what she did. She married a Catholic. An Italian one. That's the worst kind. And I was down east. They used to be in just outside of Toronto. And when I was coming from some place like this or in business, I went to visit them. The first time I went to visit them, they had this beautiful little girl. She was 3 years old. Her name is Anna Louisa. She was at the international conference with me. But I go there, and little Anna's all packed up, ready to go home with Grandpa on the airplane. So what grandpas are supposed to do is take them home. So I took her home, and the next morning, I'm doing my reading in this little room, and she's knocking on the door, and Babe said, you can't go in there, honey. Grandpa's doing his reading. And she says, well, I want to tell him something. So I said, let her come in. She came in, took her up on my knee, and I told her what I was trying to do and what I was doing, and I said, what did you want to tell me? And she says, I wanted to tell you that I love you. And I said, I want you to know that I love you too. That may not mean a thing to anybody out there, but here was an old hard rock that couldn't give love, couldn't accept love. And here's a little Catholic girl telling me she loves me and that I love her. You know, isn't it fantastic what when they say live and let live and keep an open mind what it can do? She has a little sister. Her name is Cella Maria. Not much Italian, but she is. And she just jumps up on my knee any time. Well, now they're 13 and 16 years old, beautiful kids. They go to a French Catholic school. That's not bad, but sometimes I have to drive them. And the sisters wave at me and say, good morning, Mr. Corgo. And I say, hi, honey, how are you? You know, yeah. Isn't it great what this program can do? They have a little cousin by the name of Jason. He was the International Conference in New Orleans and the one in Montreal with me. He's only 13, but he's already got more international conferences in than most people. He's a Protestant. And he and I spend a lot of time together. And one time, he and I were having the car washed, and he looked over, and there was Kentucky Fried Chicken. And he said, let's buy some chicken, Grandpa, for Grandma. I said, that's a good idea, Jason. And he said, well, while we're at it, maybe we should get some for ourselves, you know. So we got some, and we had, at that time, little chairs and tables for our grandchildren at our house. And he wanted me to sit at this little table, and we're sitting eating the chicken. And he said, you know what I want to be when I grow up, Grandpa? And I said, what do you want to be, Jason? And he said, I want to be a grandpa. And he says, I want to have a store, and I want to be the boss. The greatest compliment that I've ever received in my life is little guy that wants to be like me. And I could have lost all of that. I could have lost all of that in Alcoholics Anonymous when I was restless, irritable, and discontented. And I think a lot of people lose those things when they're restless, irritable, and discontented. And I almost did. Jason's mother got divorced from her Protestant husband and married a Catholic. And now they have a little guy. And his name is Giovanni Anthony. Don't know how to spell it. I've just learned how to pronounce it. And he's my buddy. He calls me Bapa Season. Boy, when I get home tomorrow night, he'll be there waiting for Bapa Season. I got to read him stories and do dance with him, and I'm teaching him how to... He's going to an Italian wedding, and I'm teaching him how to act. And, boy, it's going to be something. But isn't that wonderful? You know, that you can be taught love through these kids, and that you can be taught so many, many things through kids. And little Anna and Jason, when they came to, I say little Anna and Jason, my golly, they're as big as I am, but when they came to that international conference, they just loved every one of you people. And they loved you people that, I mean, I know so many people in the United States, and so many people at those big meetings came up and put their arms around me and hugged me, and they said, this must be Jason and Anna, because they know I talk about them. And they knew as many people as I did, and it was just great. And then it says, having had a spiritual awakening as a result of these steps, we tried to carry this message to alcoholics and to practice these principles in all our affairs. A spiritual awakening to me is simply a personality change. You know, yesterday morning when I got up, 4 o'clock in the morning, I went into the bathroom, and if I'd have said, holy malarkey, I have to go to Milwaukee today. I have to drive 100 miles to Saskatoon to catch an airplane. I have to fly all day. If I'd have said it that way, I'd have been played out before I got out of my bathroom. But I said, gee, I'm going back to Milwaukee to see a lot of good friends. And I'm invited back. And I'm grateful for the opportunity to come to Milwaukee, because I never know when my tee-off time's going to be. And I better do what I'm asked to do in this fellowship. Because if I ever had a purpose in life, maybe this is it. And I'm grateful that I'm here. And then it says, we tried to carry the message to the alcoholic that still suffers. A week ago Thursday, I was going away to do the same thing as I'm doing tonight. And I got a phone call, and I was selling a mother, a daughter, and a son. I was selling them 3 fur coats. And my secretary came, and she's in Al-Anon, and she said, Mr. C, I think you better take this phone call. And I went back in the office and took the phone call. It was from a man. He was going to commit suicide. He just knew me because he'd heard me speak somewhere. And he phoned me long distance. And I talked to him, and I listened to him. And I listened to him, and I said I knew how he felt, and he didn't think I knew, but we convinced each other that we both knew. And he hung up. And but it took about 15 minutes. And I went back and excused myself and showed them some more coats. And they walked out and they said, well, they'd think about it, come back. And I left to catch my plane, and I phoned when I got this 100 miles where I catch the plane. I phoned back, and my secretary said, your customers came back and they all bought fur coats. You see, it tells us in the big book, Working with Others, that these things are going to happen. And we better be prepared for them to happen. And thank God, when I was talking to that fellow on the phone, that I wasn't thinking my customers are going to run away, you know. I was thinking about the opportunity that I had to actually save a life. And that's the opportunity that we have in Alcoholics Anonymous. Whether they're going to commit suicide or not, we have the opportunity to save lives. And then it says, practice these principles in all our affairs. What principles are they talking about? I believe they're talking about step number one. I think they're talking about honesty. Step two, I think they're talking about hope. Step three, I think they're talking about faith. Step four, courage. Step five, integrity. Step six, willingness. Step seven, humility. Step eight, brotherly love. Step nine, self-discipline. Step 10, perseverance. Step 11, the ever-presence of God. Step 12, service, that we've talked so much about this weekend. And those are the beautiful principles that we have the opportunity to do every day because we belong to this beautiful fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I'm going to close with a story that I closed with 10 years ago when I was here. And there's a little gal that come and talked to me today about it, and I know it meant much to her because she remembered the story. And Pat, I'm going to tell it for you again tonight. There's a little town just outside of Omaha, Nebraska. It's a little town called Boys Town. And as you drive up, you see a statue. And it's a statue of one little boy carrying another little boy. But you can tell by the way he stooped over and by the sweat on his brow that he's having a very difficult time. But underneath are simple words, something like this. No, Lord, he is not heavy, for he is my brother. And that's what I've found in Alcoholics Anonymous, brothers and sisters all over the world. And they're not heavy because we can share each other with each other. I want to thank the committee for giving me this very, very pleasurable privilege of coming back to Milwaukee. I want to thank you, the audience, for being such a terrific audience because you listened, and it's so easy to talk when people are listening. Last but not least, I want to thank God for giving me one more beautiful day to allow me to do, I guess, what I'm supposed to be doing in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I'm going to close this talk. And I hope it helps you the same as it helped me when I was 10 years sober. Every one of you look real good on the outside tonight. How are you really on the inside? Thank you, and God bless you.